Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome, everybody. Catherine and I are very excited to welcome our guest for today, Elizabeth Gillespie. She works in the area of neurodivergence, and we get to learn a little bit about her life and her work today. And I know she's going to bring us lots of great information. And so for any of us who are working in this area or want to, stay tuned. It's going to be a great chat. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So nice to have you here, my friend. Tell us a little bit about your life and practice and what makes you passionate about working in this area.
Sure. Yeah, I have a private practice with three therapists who work with me in Boulder County in Colorado. And I actually just started off as a trained in the EFT. I'm an MFT and just headed down that path. And then my life kind of started blowing up. So a few of my dear friends and my husband were diagnosed with ADHD. And then from there, we already kind of knew, but we started getting all my children evaluated. And some of that is still ongoing. We're still kind of working through. And then kind of around the same time, I started realizing that a lot of the clients I was working with were showing some of the signs that I was becoming very familiar with. And so then I started suggesting that they be evaluated, and 100% of the time they were coming back with with the diagnosis of ADHD. And then I hired a lovely therapist who's also an OT who specializes in neurodiversity. And then that's when we really started like kind of honing in on this piece and really started seeing families come in. We really want to welcome all kinds of family, like all kinds of places for all kinds of reasons. But generally what we see is family coming in with a child who's been identified as autistic or with ADHD. And there's always sensory processing differences, learning differences that go along with all of that, and are just struggling mightily, suicidal, depressed. And sometimes they come requesting family therapy, and sometimes they come requesting that we help their child. Sometimes they come requesting we fix their child. I mean, you know, it varies.
You come to this from like a lot of personal experience in your own home, and then professionally starting to recognize these signs and actually make a home in your practice for these families. Mm-hmm. And as you're talking about the kinds of kiddos that come through the doors, yeah, I was wondering, like, how are the parents doing? How do they show up? And
yeah,
how open are they to treatment, and how exhausted are they? My goodness.
Oh my goodness. This is such a parallel process for me, because I'm looking in the eyes of these parents and I know what they are feeling, right?
What are they feeling?
It's usually if their child is unsafe, right? There's so much fear, right? That's the biggest one. But the kind of thing the place that I connect and I just feel it to my bones because I know it so well is the helplessness, and the exhaustion of identifying what's going on with your child, which that in alone is huge, right? And then even once you know that, then how do you support them? Medication is an amazing tool, and just so thankful for it. And it doesn't fix everything, as we know, right? And how the exhaustion of trying to learn, and I have the advantage of being a therapist, how this child needs to be supported, how they don't make the child the identified patient, right? How they deal with, there's usually violence with the kids. I mean, there's depression, there's massive friend issues, really having trouble connecting. That's one thing that, and the parents are so worn out. And then they are having to fight and fight and fight and fight. Sometimes I say it's like I only ever live in fight mode because they're trying to get accommodations for their children in schools. And we have wonderful schools, but it's still difficult, right? Because our system isn't great. And then there's like for every diagnosis, there's about 8 or 9 services that they need, and they're all private pay. And so they're also usually really strapped financially, and not sure how to choose. And then there's of course marital issues because, you know, you're turning on each other because you're the difficulty of knowing how to engage with your child or children. And then you add the extra layer, and this is, I think, so important. Neurodiversity is highly heritable, right? Highly heritable. So if one parent has ADHD, then their child has a 50 to 60% chance of also having ADHD. But if both parents do, it's 100% chance. And what we've learned in our life is, so we tend to be attracted to people who are neurodiverse. Like, they're interesting, they're smart, they think outside the box. It's kind of like everybody we know, honestly, in our friend group. And so then you're also dealing with parents who really can struggle with their own executive functioning, which is a huge piece of ADHD, or a really painful, doesn't happen in my family, thankfully, but, or there is a parent who is dismissive of their own diagnosis or is denying or hasn't pursued their own diagnosis. And so then therefore does the same to their child. Right. And then that, of course, causes massive family issues. Or they do identify it, but they're focusing on their child so much. They haven't taken the time to get their own evaluation and take medication. And so they can't get their act together to do all the things that need to be done. They can't remember to get the meds refilled. They can't. And then the guilt and the shame and then the paralyzation, you know,
it sounds heavy. My goodness, it's so many different layers and pieces. And not only are you managing this in your own family life, but then you're taking on cases like this in your practice. And because what I'm curious about is, when families like this arrive on your doorstep, like, where do you begin? Who are you working with? Because the kids need so much. The parents do too. They're so burnt out. Where do you even begin when you look like this?
Yeah. I mean, initially we just saw whoever they wanted us to see. and then through experience and through Catherine's help, we really started changing our flexibility around who we would name as the identified patient. And so at this point, when we have a minor, so when a parent calls about a minor, the way we're kind of doing it now is we ask that the whole family come to the first session, and we don't necessarily even start talking about family therapy. And Catherine, this is also learned from you, right? Like, because once you get them all in the room, then all of a sudden all the things start coming out, right? And then the sell for family therapy is much, much easier. And it is a little tricky as I think we all know, to sometimes convincing everybody to come to the first appointment is a little tricky. And so sometimes it does take a few appointments before we get everybody there.
Okay.
We don't do consultation calls anymore, because what we've learned is, with these cases, they are so complex. They usually come with tons of paperwork to read for patients. I mean, that's actually best case scenario, that comes with tons of paperwork. Or we don't. I will say we have less. When people are coming in for bringing their kid in, they already have a diagnosis, and the parents may or may not already have that diagnosis. We're also running into scenarios where we're working with the individual or the couple, and then we realize something's going on. We refer them out, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait, my kid. Oh, wait. And then they start pursuing that. And then the whole family kind of blows up in a good way, but hard. And then we refer to couples work or refer to family work. So we do see it happen that way too. And it's so messy.
What are you reflecting on right now? It just takes,
I mean, we know the layers of family therapy to begin with, right? There's just more people in the room, the more layers, the more complexity.
Yeah.
Right. But when we're dealing with these diagnoses, which then suggests even if they know some, that there may be some out there that we still don't know.
Yeah.
And in the world of neurodiversity, we have tons of research and it's changed so much in the last 10 years. And I'm so grateful. And also there is still so much we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many more things to consider, from like how your couch feels and how that's, or mm-hmm. what the sound is, or what it smells like.
Yeah.
Whether the kid, I mean, if the kid has autism, and is young, like we have, they're not staying in the office. They're going to be roaming the office. So then how do we adapt our space? So that's an okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
The sensory tools that we need to bring in. I'm really learning from Jenna, who works with me, this is the OT, about how to get really curious from the beginning, in addition to all the other things we're assessing as EFT therapists, is also where they struggle with sensory stuff. Because if they're coming out every time and they're overwhelmed by loud noise, and there's one child who, you know, we need to actually know these things.
Elizabeth, I want to slow you down because you're saying so many good things and I just want to make sure I'm absorbing this. On the one hand, you're saying with these families, information sort of unfolds as you go. It's going to be a journey in terms of getting to know the family and everybody, and it kind of opens up that conceptualization over time. So it unfolds as you go. Patricia Crittenden, an attachment theorist, she actually knew Bowlby and studied with Ainsworth. She said, no family therapist should ever know the answer to each family's problems. They should just be someone who's willing to journey with them. And it's reminding me of what you're saying now. You're coming in as a companion, as a container, as a stronger, wiser other, holding the family, waiting to see what's going to reveal itself. And at the same time, you're holding this tricky bit that if kids don't like therapy and they don't like coming in, you don't have that many chances. Like once a kid's decided that therapy sucks, the room isn't feeling safe or comfortable, it can be hard to get them back through the door. And so you've had to really make a lot of accommodations in your space just to be a welcoming place so that you can sit with the parents and start figuring these different pieces out. Yeah. Let them show up.
Right. For the kids to feel comfortable in their own skin, like just think of all the senses, right? And for the kids to have room to move. It feels so important for two things. Like I think every time a kid or like a client comes out of the hall and, you know, and I'm walking down the hall and a kid escapes from family therapy and comes down the hall and the parents following that look, right? That look of like, is this going to be okay? Right. Because everywhere they go, nobody thinks their kid is okay. Like it is
embarrassing that, right? They face so much judgment and criticism, I imagine.
Judgment. So much misunderstanding about their child. And also I've experienced this, like the old school things come into my head where I judge my children, right? Even though I know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You're disobedient, you're a naughty child, it's so mm-hmm. easy to go back to those mm-hmm. phrases.
Yeah. And I think so giving a place for kids and parents where they can relax, where when their kid does the thing, whatever that is, right? And to varying degrees, you have compassion and you just keep going.
What does your space actually look like? I'm finding myself curious if it looks like a different practice to mine, you know?
Well, currently we're crammed into this office that has way too much stuff in it. And it's way overstimulating, but we are in the process of creating. It is an old crappy building in the back building that we have taken over and we are fixing up. So one, it's nice enough, but the parents are going to feel like if their kid, I don't know.
Yeah. It's not
or whatever. They don't care. Right. It's fine. They're not, it's a space and it's big. And it's one room and it has its own bathroom. And so we can control the scents of the soap, the options to wash your hands. We're going to have I'm still learning about this. Most of this comes from Jenna, who's also an OT, who's a family therapist in my practice. But, you know, those swings that they can have.
Yeah. Does it look sort of like an OT room?
It could. I actually do have a friend who provides this kind of an OT type space. We still keep it primarily as a therapy room. Okay. There are toys in there. There's a few things. There'll be a bean bag that all the children will fight about that we'll work through, right? Mm-hmm. That we'll work through that process. And so, I'm kind of in the thick of thinking of the details of this. We care a lot about color and all of that. And it varies very much person by person, but a soothing, calm place, kind of the opposite of what like US classrooms look like. We're going for like calm, quiet, other than the children. They don't have to be quiet, or the family.
That sounds amazing. I'm so glad you've got this new space.
So excited about it. And we'll learn, I'm sure. I'm sure we'll be adapting as we go. But I think, Kevin, this thing you said about, like, I don't remember who, I already lost her name, who you quoted.
Oh, Patricia, Dr. Crittenden.
Mm. That idea feels so central and vital to work. I mean, I think to work in all themes, but especially with these families, because what I've learned is when I suddenly ended up with all these clients who were neurodiverse, and well, they were all along, but I didn't know. It worked, even though I had no idea what I was doing, because the EFT model had taught me how to follow clients in the ways that I needed to. And as long as I stayed open and curious and didn't stay the expert, we found our way. And then when I started actually learning more about how to work with this, I was like, oh, we were doing that. Well, good. You know, it was that feeling, because I just having to hold, I mean, as a therapist, we always need this, but it feels especially important when you're working with a population that has been misunderstood.
Yeah.
And felt misunderstood their entire lives.
Yeah.
Right.
And being marginalized by the school systems and
they're bad, right?
You're talking about alliance, like taking on a family and going all in with them and taking the time and the space to get to know them, whatever is going to unfold and come.
Yeah.
That they start to trust your intention and they buy into that relationship with you. You don't have the answers. You're not the expert, but you're in it with them and you're going to help them journey to these resources.
Yeah.
Is that the thing that's so central, do you think?
Yeah. I think that's huge. Really, really showing them that we're curious and open and that we care deeply about the intricacies of their experience. And we're not going to quickly overlabel it or slap an emotion on it. We're going to stay really open and curious. But it is alliance. And we conceptualize it with families in this way of like, okay, we are not going to solve any of the quote problems with your child. We don't know the answers. The answers don't really exist. But what we are going to do is we're going to walk with you. And we are going to help you find resources. And most importantly, we are going to hold the goodness of every person in the room. We are going to hold the parent, you know, like we do in EFFT, the good intentions of the parent, like how desperate, like how much this parent is struggling and how much this parent wants help for their child and how hard it is and how much they know they're messing up all the time and they're doing it anyway, which feels awfully familiar. Hold their exhaustion. Like, I mean, that's every family, but there's just this added layer, right? And then we're going to, I mean, that this is the part, I mean, Catherine, I just remember I was just in Catherine's family therapy training. And I, when you talked about that, there'd be nothing more important than, I don't have your exact words, but like strengthening the relationship between the teen or in their parent, like what else matters more than that? And we know that connection decreases symptoms, negative symptoms of ADHD. We know that, right? And the regulation that comes from connection is vital for, well, for all of us, but for neurodiversity. And so helping, you know, wherever, helping strengthen that relationship. And I don't know, nothing seems more important than that, right?
You're saying on the one hand, like there's so little that one can do because there's so much that's unknown and there's so many different interesting symptoms. And yet the most important thing is alliance building and caring and connection. And we do know how to do that.
We know how to do that.
And when you said a child who feels connected, that actually, that affects their symptoms, even with ADHD, is that true? Like, how does that work? Do you know? I'm sure you know all about this.
There's a lot of different reasons, but like the piece that I think matters a lot to me that I think about is like one of the, Dr. Thomas Brown, he's actually your way.
Okay.
He's like one of those who kind of wrote the book on ADHD. He created a new model, really steeped in research, about the, I think it's 6 components of ADHD, like kind of what makes it up. And he has a scaling system that people use to evaluate. It's amazing. One of the pieces that he brought in that other people have gone to carry on further is that emotional modulation is a piece that individuals with ADHD struggle with greatly. So whatever emotion they are currently feeling, and this is in general, right? The only emotion they can feel. It's very hard to like identify more than one at a time. It is all consuming and they feel it's way stronger than a neurotypical person would be. See that present, you know, depending on attachment style, either is they're constantly flooded with emotion or they're constantly dismissing emotion because it's just too much, right?
Yeah.
And also there's this thing called there's working memory is a problem. So carrying their person with them inside of them is actually harder. And even remembering in their body and in their mind experiences they've had in the therapy room or outside that are good and different, new, these things we want to facilitate, they don't stick as quickly. So I got off track a little bit, but you can just see like all of those pieces come together to make a really dysregulated human being.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And also can be very disconnected from their body, a lot less understanding of emotion.
The feelings they're feeling are way more intense. So intense that they might have to dismiss them altogether. They can't access that working memory that would remind them in that moment about an internalized comfort figure. Also can't connect into the body as much. And so it's just so much harder to get regulated. And then when you do create these emotional corrective moments in treatment, they might not stick as deeply. And so maybe you want to stimulate different senses and Mm-hmm. Like, it's maybe treatment takes longer, but it also looks a little more creative, maybe, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I feel like I'm still experimenting. Well, why don't we try this? Well, maybe this will. But yes, I do think the therapy takes longer for all of those things that we've just said and more.
Can you give us an example of a moment of connection and session and how it might look slightly different to what we think of as an EFFT typical session?
Oh, there's so many examples. I think one example might be, I'm thinking of a client in particular. It really often would feel like coming back into the session that there was almost no memory of, like, say they had a really good connective experience and they went and had a fight. We couldn't get back there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so sometimes these are some of the things I'm experimenting with while trying to stay true to the model, right? Because I highly value that. Is it's almost like I have to give a little bit more of a scaffolding, a little bit more structure, allow a little bit more intellectualization than normally I to kind of like hold on to things. I think I have some learning to do about also working with sensory stuff more. So like, if we could move more, if we could use this, if we could try this, if we could experiment, like, what would that do? Because I don't see any place to read this. So we're really just kind of like trying things and seeing like, okay, that seemed to work.
I'm thinking of this, a 10 or 11 year old, 9 year old boy who came in recently with his dad, and the family hadn't necessarily named it ADHD, but it seemed pretty clear that this is what the kiddo was struggling with. And even just having them enter into the session was tricky. There was a sense of shame and it was awkward. And then I remember learning that he was a very creative child and just pulled out some creative art stuff. And as he and dad started sitting, and I might have even have given them a little challenge of something to draw. And then immediately they just started relaxing with their bodies. They started having some fun. And then we ended up talking about all the relevant issues.
Yeah, it's a fine balance of that, sticking to the model, and then like it's our true north, right?
But yeah.
And taking these side paths aren't in contradiction to the model, right?
Right. But it's actually helping us build the alliance by tuning into the sensory needs, the physiological needs, right?
Beautiful. Yes. Well said. Yeah. I always love how you put things together with words. Yeah. I think that's exactly, and just feeling the safety and comfort to do that, which can be scary because family therapy can be scary, period.
Well, I know in moments like that where I can't just go to the typical model, it's not working, like I don't have engagement. I sit there as a therapist thinking, oh no, what do I do? Like at that point, I get a little shocked and I have to think outside the box, and it needs to just be about, hey, how do I join? How do I engage? How do I make this room a fun, safe, cool space to be a part of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a lot of moments like that with families like this, I imagine.
Yeah, I was thinking, and sometimes I feel like I get stuck in these places where we have to go on these intellectual tangents that feel, you know, like I worked so hard to get out of my head. I mean, I still am as a therapist. And now I've got clients who are like, I'm trying to stop, but it's clear that they need to, especially if we're dealing with autism. Like, I need to talk about this, I don't know, bird for 10 minutes, right? In joining them there, because they never, I mean, I think I have a daughter who it's complex, so I'm kind of figuring out exactly where she lands. But when she starts talking about something she's really interested in, that intellectual understanding and her sense of self are so tied.
Yeah.
If I'm dismissive of the bird she wants to talk about, it doesn't feel the same way it happens. I mean, all of us want people to care about what we care about, but it just feels like there's more of an identification with that thing that she's thinking about or obsessing about in the moment. And if I can't sit and listen, even though I can be very bored as both a therapist and a parent when the thing talks about 10 minutes, and it feels so not EFT, but it really is. It's that. It's in service of the alliance, right? And then we come back.
Think of what you were saying earlier, that when she's talking about the bird, she's feeling that intensely. It's very, very important to her. There's probably very few people who understand that. And so she rarely has a chance where someone goes in all the way. And then the EFT attachment bit is seeing her and understanding who she is and what makes her come alive. And even if you aren't that interested in the bird stuff, you're interested in getting to know her as a little human being and how her brain works, which comes back into the alliance piece, because she can feel that you're there with her or not.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some parents just love having the opportunity of someone else caring. And some parents actually have no idea. They're so ashamed of how their child shows up that way, for us to model that engagement and connection around the thing that's happening in their brain, but is also in their body.
Yeah. And then being able to explain it later to the parents if you need to, right?
Gosh, Elizabeth and Catherine, as I have been leaning back and being a listener and an observer, but also a participant in this conversation, what comes to mind for me and what my brain is connecting in my summary is this parallel process, this isomorphic process of the therapist offering that attunement and that curiosity and openness and flexibility of being with and being open to what reveals itself, and that experience of offering connection. And even if it's 10 minutes talking about a bird, about how those 10 minutes are so critical for that sense of self for that child or that adult. And that therapist is tuned into those 10 minutes and understands the importance of that 10 minutes. And then they don't feel connected at school or in the school systems. And there's a fight that the parents do to find the right fit, a goodness of fit for their child, for their sense of self. Because when we're connected, when we're regulated, right? And this, I'm sure there's polyvagal words for this too, but I don't know them. That social engagement system, right? Then we can grow. Then we can learn. And I just feel so fired up right now in my brain and my body as I listen to the two of you talk about this parallel process. And I just think it's really beautiful. And that's what my body was going through as I was listening you two chat about this.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's so, I mean, you're putting to words why it feels so good, right? To do this, to offer that, right? To see the unseen, to know the unknown, like that. It's so important and so beautiful. That's the thing.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm tearing up. I don't work with many families with neurodivergence. It's a area just I have not been able to grow in. I actually lean more on the OCD side, so it's kind of hard for my brain to experience that. But I am just so tearful just sitting with you and being an observer and a participant of this conversation, because it's just so important and meaningful to these kiddos, these minors, these teens, these adults, and these families, that they feel seen and understood. And that they really long for that in all of their areas of life. And it just makes me fired up.
Elizabeth, I could sit and talk to you all day. I'm amazed at the way you manage your practice. I wish I could come and visit and just see what you're doing there and sit in on a couple cases. And also just inspired by how you manage your family and how you're living this in both worlds. So I really appreciate you sharing with us from both a personal and professional place.
Thank you. Thank you for talking to me about it. It's really nice.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us. And I'll just echo what Catherine says about where there may be a lack of research or information. You are just approaching families with openness and curiosity and willingness to experiment and walk alongside them And I know that they're in really good hands just because that is a great foundation to start from.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Elizabeth, I think you are doing some talks on this in the EFT community next year. And I know you've also got a TED talk. Can you tell us a bit about what might be coming and where we can find you?
Yeah, my TED talk was EFT 101. Anybody in the EFT world is very familiar with it last year. And then I'm trying to remember when. Next November, that's the biggest one that I am teaching on neurodiversity in the tango. And just the way that EFT is both a beautiful model for neurodiversity. It's perfect. So, and also just the places that we can get stuck.
Fantastic. That sounds practical.
Yeah.
So November 2024, and we will put your email, if that's okay, or your website.
Sure.
Podcast, so people can find you there.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.